Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. So what's your house worth? And how, pray tell, do you know that? The only true way is to either sell it or get an appraiser to put a number on it. But how, pray tell, do they know?
I'd like to think that we're all realtors, especially me, are so perfect in our analysis that we can so accurately determine what the right purchase price is. But it's more an art than it is a science.
We'll appraise the appraisers this week and get ready for the 30-day budget challenge.
We spend money needlessly, and we can all be more careful if we just have it down on paper.
And since we're talking budgets, one way to help that budget might be to get rid of some of your old valuables.
I have some Beanie Babies. I don't know if you know what those are. I think they have those.
I was thinking more of a Renoir, really.
No.
Yard sale chic. Then and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Here's how you know we've been living in a bad economic news bubble. The Case-Shiller Housing Index came out this week. Prices in February dropped more than 18% from a year ago. But the headline? For the first time in more than 2 years, it wasn't a record decline. I think that's what they call being grateful for small mercies. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
When it comes to those falling housing prices, Miami has taken one of the biggest hits, according to the Case-Shiller Index we just mentioned. 30% drop from a year ago. And according to the Florida Association of Realtors, prices for condos have fallen as much as 10% faster than for single-family homes. For some investors and would-be homebuyers, smells like opportunity. But you better do your homework first. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports from the Sunshine State.
Steve Economou and his wife Janie were tired of winters in Boston, so they followed a path laid by generations of Northeastern retirees. They became snowbirds.
I was interested in getting a place in Florida. I want to be left out. Prices came down. I figured I might as well take advantage of it.
Economou, a retired government microbiologist, bet much of his life savings about a month ago on a winter home in Boca Raton. He paid $157,000 in cash for a two-bedroom, two-bath condo on a golf course. Economou says he didn't do much research into the condominium complex he bought into.
We just took a chance, and we hope we're lucky.
Frank Thomas is Economou's realtor. He says the condo was recently remodeled and fully furnished.
We got him an excellent deal. So our price was probably 40% of what it sold for in 2005.
Stories of fantastic deals like this one abound in South Florida and other areas hit hardest by falling prices. But what's rarely discussed are the potential landmines when buying a condo as opposed to a single-family house. Condos can be harder and more expensive to finance, and when you buy into a condominium, you inherit its financial problems. Economou, like most buyers, didn't know about these potential landmines, but his realtor, Frank Thomas, did. Thomas says it took a lot of work to make sure there were no potential traps with this property.
You don't find diamonds on the surface. You know, you dig through the rubble. You know what a diamond looks like when it's rough, and they don't always sparkle, you know what I mean? And so if you're experienced and you know the things to look for and you dig correctly and you ask the right questions, those deals are out there.
Experts say the first questions you have to ask are about the financial health of a condominium complex. How many units are in foreclosure? How many homeowners are late in paying their dues? Jack McCabe heads a real estate research company. He says when you purchase a condo, you don't just own your own unit. You also own a piece of the golf course, the swimming pool, the leaky roof, the rusty plumbing, and the 24-hour security guard at your front gate.
Condominiums, you're totally reliant on all your neighbors around you to be paying their bills, to be paying their mortgage, to be paying their homeowners association dues, so everything is well maintained.
When your neighbors stop paying their dues, you could be on the hook for tens of thousands of dollars in special assessments just to keep the sprinklers running. Elise Glink is author of 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask. She says if a condo board is cagey about its finances, walk away.
Any condo board that refuses to disclose information about the delinquencies, the condo reserves, the board minutes, and the budget is not a condo I would want to buy in.
Glink says as you ask these questions, you should have an experienced realtor by your side.
So when you're searching for an agent, look for somebody with market expertise who's been in the business 10 or 15 years and who can really help you understand what true value is for the neighborhood you're looking in.
Buying in a depressed market can also mean hidden costs, like huge first-year tax bills. Realtor Doug DeWitt says this has become a big problem in some luxury condo buildings in Miami.
There were units selling as high as $800,000, and some of these were staged transactions that involved mortgage fraud. Now those same units are up for sale, you know, as low as $150,000, $200,000, but the assessed value within the county tax assessor's office still reflects that fraudulent, hyperinflated value of $800,000.
That can mean paying thousands of dollars in extra real estate taxes. But perhaps the biggest challenge to buying a condo these days is financing. Jack McCabe says banks keep blacklists of condo buildings they won't touch. Even government lenders have become hyper-conservative.
The FHA, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac now have come up with additional restrictions on granting loans in condominium buildings. Now, for markets like Florida, Las Vegas, Tucson, Phoenix, California, Chicago, that rules out almost all of the condominium buildings.
Condo sales once outpaced those of single-family houses, but because of tight credit on condos, that trend has reversed. At the current pace, it would take 9 months to clear the nation's supply of single-family houses, and nearly twice as long to sell off all the condos. McCabe says if you're looking to buy a condo, be prepared to pay in cash. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Remember that parlor game we used to play back in, fall of 06 or so? It went something like this. You'd mention the house you just bought. I'd ask how much you paid, and you'd tell me. And then we'd both blather on about how our homes were worth like 300% more than when we bought them. Well, in truth, your house is only worth what someone else is willing to pay for it. And what an appraiser tells you it's worth. Home appraisers have taken a good chunk of the blame for the real estate bubble and their role in setting those inflated prices. Well, new regulations are in effect as of this weekend that will theoretically make appraisals more independent than they were. Tamara Keith reports on exactly how appraisals work.
Jim Duncan is a realtor in Charlottesville, Virginia, and we're looking at a white vinyl-sided pseudo-Victorian he just helped his clients buy.
It was on the market for about $500,000 and ultimately closed for about $415,000.
As part of the loan process, the lender ordered up an appraisal to make sure the house was really worth that $415,000. And Duncan says the appraisal came back just about right, a couple thousand dollars more than the final sale price. He and other realtors say this happens all the time. Duncan finds the spot-on appraisal surprising, since the ultimate purchase price is really the result of a negotiation and not just hard data about the market.
I'd like to think that we're all realtors, and especially me, are so perfect in our analysis that we can so accurately determine what the purchase price is, the right purchase price is. But, you know, frankly, it's more an art than it is a science.
Duncan says some of his realtor friends say it's odd that appraisers that are supposed to be objective get to see the sales contract.
The perception is that they are given a target.
Because the appraisers see what number seals the sale. Appraisers are supposed to review the sales contract, but that isn't supposed to unduly influence their appraisal. But longtime appraiser Karen Pape says at the height of the housing boom, lenders sometimes pressured her to come up with a price close to the sales price. In other words, a price that wouldn't kill the deal.
hey, wait a minute, you know, I've just spent hours working on this, and I've developed an opinion of value that is valid, and you're telling me that I just have to, you know, change my number just so you can make the loan so I can get more business?
Yep. She says the conversation went something like this.
I am a big volume lender, and when I say jump, I expect you to say how high.
Pape says she stopped working with certain lenders because, as she puts it, they didn't respect her opinions. But some appraisers played along. That helped fuel the boom, led to the bust, and finally prompted the new Home Valuation Code of Conduct. Bill Garber represents the Appraisal Institute, an association of appraisers. He says during the boom, the appraisal process lost some of its independence, and loan officers with financial stakes in the deal got the upper hand.
The Code of Conduct attempts to make clear that there must be a firewall between loan production and risk management and the appraisal process.
So how is the appraisal process supposed to work? It turns out appraisals aren't all that mysterious.
So this is an assignment. I'm working on an appraisal for a lender.
Betsy Kreiser works at Pape & Company in Charlottesville. She's several hours into an appraisal for a house refinance. Under the new code of conduct, she won't interact with loan officers. Instead, an appraisal management company, one step removed, or the bank's risk management division, hires appraisers.
This is the sketch just showing the dimensions, the exterior dimensions of the home.
She's already been to the house, measured each room, noted the countertops in the kitchen and other improvements. Sometimes she says homeowners have a number in mind, and they'll tell her their target price.
We have to try and ignore that because we can't let that influence us.
Appraisals mostly involve just crunching numbers. Kreiser pulls up data on recently sold houses in the neighborhood, and she adjusts their sale prices to match the features in the home she's appraising. And then, after staring at her monitor for a while, eureka.
So, given that, I'm probably going to come in right here at 316.
So why do those appraisal numbers so often exactly match the sales price? Kreiser swears sometimes it just works out that way. And other times, the appraisal comes in too low or too high and kills the deal.
You know, we certainly aren't in a position where we have anything to gain one way or the other anyhow. And our job ultimately is to serve our client, and that's the lender.
And what's in the best interests of lenders? Making mortgage loans that are actually a good deal for everyone involved. I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace Money.
Remember crotchety old Mr. Potter, the banker from the 1946 movie It's a Wonderful Life? Here's a vision of what he might be up to today.
Now Mr. Potter is probably sending out credit cards unsolicited because the 12-year-olds who are getting these from Mr. Potter could be running up interest rates of 25-30%, you know, which mount up very quickly.
Coming up, we'll hear an argument that usury got us into this economic crisis. And later on the show, if you're a bargain hunter, you know yard sales are the place to find great deals. But these days, you might find something else, a very motivated seller.
We're having a big party for my son coming up, and I'm not working right now, so I'm thinking, well, how am I going to pay for this? So I'm having a garage sale.
It's all on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. And now it's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And joining me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Tess. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. I had a very nice vacation. Back in the saddle, though. And, you know, I was looking at savings accounts, actually, while I was on vacation. You know, I have noticed, and I'm hoping you can explain for me, you know, this whole notion that we're all supposed to be saving more. Well, you can save more, but you're not getting any kind of return on your money. In fact, I have noticed that in a new savings account that I opened recently, an online savings account, my interest rate dropped twice in less than a month. But the Fed isn't doing anything. So why are all these interest rates dropping all over the place?
I think there are three main factors going on. First of all, there's really no demand for credit. Typically, when lots of people want to borrow, the price of credit goes up or the interest rate goes up.
Right.
And when people are sitting back and saying, I'm not borrowing, you got to be kidding me, interest rates go down. So that's one factor.
So as a saver, I'm getting hurt by the borrowers or the non-borrowers.
By the non-borrowers. But think about it this way. The Fed has worked hard to lower interest rates, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're being penalized as a saver. But borrowers, they're getting the deal of a half century. When was the last time mortgage interest rates were this low? So it's essentially a wealth transfer from savers to borrowers.
So no matter what the Fed is doing, then banks are looking at supply and demand and seeing that nobody's borrowing. So they're bringing down interest rates for all of the savers as well.
That's right. And then, you know, there's really no inflation out there, which is another thing that would raise interest rates. But since we're not worried about inflation, no pressure on interest rates.
So the only place where I could get a better return on my money would be what? Go back into the stock market?
Well, you could go back in the stock market. Junk bonds, junk muni bonds. Oh, Tess, I got all kinds of things I can sell you. But here's the thing. You don't want to do that. The economy is weak. Your money is there. It's going to be safe if it's FDIC insured, if it's in treasury bills. No interest, but the money will be there tomorrow when you need it.
All right. Safety with no return. I guess I'll have to stick with that. Thanks so much, Chris. We'll talk to you later in the show.
Thanks a lot.
So everybody wants to know who is to blame for this financial mess that we are all in. Was it the bankers? Was it the regulators? Regular Joes and Janes who just way overextended themselves? Labor lawyer Thomas Gagin has another theory that he wrote about in the April issue of Harper's Magazine. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tess.
Your article is called Infinite Debt, and your argument is that the legalization of super high interest rates, usury, is at the root of all this. Take us through your argument.
From the beginning of the dawn of human civilization up until the Reagan era, there were always caps on the interest rates that banks could charge. But even in our own modern era, economists from Adam Smith to John Maynard Keynes all wrote about how it's important to keep returns to the financial sector low so that you don't have money gushing out of manufacturing and the areas of our economy that make us globally competitive, that feed on technological developments, and going into, well, what is a kind of parasitical, usurious form of capitalism, which is the finance sector. That's what I was basically trying to get at, that when we deregulated interest rate caps and let interest rates that had been capped historically in our country at 9%, 8%, 7% even, to go as high as 20, 25, 35% on credit cards, we really gave the financial sector the chance to suck capital out of manufacturing. That's what has brought about this catastrophe.
When you say that high interest rates sent money gushing out of the manufacturing sector, explain that tie for me. How does that happen?
Sure.
How does one lead to the other?
We became addicted to very, very high returns in the financial sector. We have an economy where we had too much money going into Chase and Lehman and Bear Stearns, no longer with us, and not enough to GMs and Chryslers and satellites of those big companies. History is a turf war between manufacturing, labor, and banking. We don't have much of a labor movement anymore to put a claim on the national output. And manufacturing, after the deregulation of the interest rate caps that it historically applied to finance, began to lose out too, so that all we had left was a financial sector that everybody in one way or another has been working for.
Well, you make the argument that lenders wanted us all to be irresponsible. You know, the worse off the borrower, the more the bank made in interest. But you can't believe it was a conscious strategy.
If you go back and see the movie It's a Wonderful Life, Mr. Potter, the bad guy in the movie, is always being very difficult about loaning any money to people, even small amounts, because the old mantra was the loan must be repaid. And the reason the loan must be repaid is that Mr. Potter in that movie, God bless him, isn't making all that much off of people. He's under very tight restrictions, probably only getting 7 or 8% on these loans at most.
So now he would be the good guy.
Now Mr. Potter is probably sending out credit cards unsolicited because the 12-year-olds who are getting these from Mr. Potter could be running up interest rates of 25, 30%, you know, which mount up very quickly. So Mr. Potter doesn't really want the loan to be completely repaid. He loves the accumulation of interest at this level. And if you've got a country of Mr. Potters like this, people are going to be looking for the big returns to which the financial sector got addicted to once we deregulated usury.
Well, these days it's become much harder to get credit, so we're theoretically not paying as much interest. You can't pay interest on credit you don't have or can't get, but do you believe that this situation, the current situation, will remain? Will we become a nation of Mr. Potters again?
Tess, at the moment, that's the whole point of the stimulus plan, to get us back to where we were before, a debt-fueled country that lives off credit, unless we decide that we're going to make a concerted effort in this country to start making things, investing things, and going back to the old kind of capitalism that did exist in Mr. Potter's day, which happened to be Franklin Roosevelt's day as well.
Well, you do have some ideas about how to solve this that you outline in the article, and your solutions are not about bailing out the banks.
Pass a law against usury, that's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Have each of the 50 states charter banks that would issue credit cards at rates that are much lower than what private banks charge. Put public guardians on the board of directors of the banks that we are bailing out right now.
Hmm.
And finally, I'm very big on the idea that we've got to inject equity into people and not just into banks. So those are my basic points for getting out of this world where we're all in debt to the banks.
All right. Thomas Gagan is a labor lawyer in Chicago, and his article, Infinite Debt, How Unlimited Interest Rates Destroy the Economy, appeared in Harper's Magazine last month. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear conversations with poets about the economy, music, cooking, and more at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
We've received lots of letters expressing the difficulties of living through this recession. You've lost jobs. You've lost entire nest eggs. You're wondering how you'll get to the next paycheck. It is a trying time emotionally for many, many people. You've probably heard the stories of some who just couldn't take it anymore and committed suicide. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott tells us, the economy is rarely the only factor in these cases.
A listener wrote into the show recently. I'll call him Cliff. His wife made some real estate investments during the boom that didn't work out. The banks called several times a day. The mail was piling up. Cliff said he'd been having trouble sleeping. He'd been thinking about suicide. He agreed to share his story if we disguised his voice.
The last year and a half has been really tough. Quite a few sleepless nights, worrying about, millions of dollars of mortgage debt. It's a nightmare.
Cliff got some legal help. He's now considering bankruptcy. He says he felt a lot better when he learned he wouldn't have to lose his home.
I just didn't know how I would cope with it and how I would handle it. And I think what has really relieved that stress is talking to an attorney, a bankruptcy attorney, and finding out where you stand legally.
Many people don't get help soon enough. Stories have been popping up of people in dire financial straits who've taken their own lives. But experts say while financial stress may have played a role in some cases, it's usually just one factor. Sherry's husband, Tom, ended his life last June. She didn't want us to use her last name to protect her children. She had lost her job. Tom sold used cars, and his sales were down. But Sherry says she now knows there was a lot more going on.
I do think that financial stress was a contributing factor, but it was part of a much bigger picture. I believe that my husband suffered from serious depression and did so for a pretty long time.
Lanny Berman is executive director of the American Association of Suicidology.
We know that about 90% of all completed suicides occur among people who retrospectively can be diagnosed as having a significant mental disorder.
He says those disorders include depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress, and schizophrenia. For someone who's already vulnerable, a job loss or foreclosure, like any loss, can trigger a crisis. But Berman says fears of a recession-related epidemic are unfounded. He says while suicide rates did increase slightly during the Great Depression,
we've had something in the way of a dozen or more recessions since the Great Depression. And most of those have been relatively short-lived, and there's been no evident relationship between those recessions and subsequent suicide rates.
Studies have shown some links between unemployment and suicide. Anara Gard is deputy director of the Suicide Prevention Resource Center. She says especially for men, the loss of a job can threaten their very identity.
Their work may be who they most feel who they are, and when they lose that and lose the capacity to support their family, it's that change in role, not just the change in economic status, that can be so hard to incorporate into one's new sense of life and who you are.
Gard says the connection between unemployment and suicide is complicated. When people lose their jobs, they may also lose their access to mental health care and other resources. But there are free and low-cost options out there. Gard says many cities have community mental health centers that offer counseling on a sliding scale.
I think it's important for listeners and their family members to reach out in many different ways. They can turn to their clergyman or rabbi, if they have one, to family, to friends, their doctors, mental health providers, employee assistance providers, if they still have one. And I really encourage people, don't just turn in one direction. You may have to turn in many directions to get enough support to get you through these tough times.
Cliff, the listener who wrote in about his financial troubles, turned to legal help. Others may need medical help. Sherry, who lost her husband last year, says she believes if he'd had psychiatric care, he'd still be alive today. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
And Amy passes along that if you or someone you know is in trouble, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline for free in English or Spanish. The number is 1-800-273-TALK. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, it's time to take some of your questions for Getting Personal. And with me again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's go to another Chris who is on the phone with us from Chico, California. Hi, Chris.
How's it going?
Doing all right, doing all right. What's your question for the other Chris today?
Well, I'm going to be unfortunately losing my job in about a month.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
I've got some looming debt, but I also have some securities that I would be able to sell it essentially to pay off that debt.
What kind of debt? What kind of debt load are we talking about?
About $20,000. It is comprised of a student loan, a vehicle loan, and some credit card debt.
Okay. And what do you think your stocks are worth?
Right now, they are worth about $20,000. It was considerably more before the fallout.
I have one other question I want to toss in there, Tess. Do we have some savings set aside already with the job loss looming?
Yes, we do. I've got about 2 to 3 months worth of salary. Once the job gets terminated, I'll get another about 1.5 months worth of salary. But if I was to pay off all this debt with the stocks and bonds that I have, then I think that money would last quite a bit longer.
So one way of thinking about this is the more you're at risk when you lose your job, the less you worry about what's a good investment strategy, and it's more create as much safety as possible. What I would do is get rid of the credit card debt. Just get rid of that. So I would sell to get rid of the credit card debt. And then depending on how much the vehicle debt is, you may also want to attack that. With the student loan debt, you have some flexibility. Contact the student loan lender. Tell them what your situation is. You need to stretch out the payments, and they'll work with you. Now, you know, there's always a price that you pay over a longer period of time because you've increased the total payment. But there's no prepayment penalty with student loans, so you can always go back to your old payment habits once you get a new job.
Okay, sounds good.
Chris, can I ask what industry you're in?
I am in the building and planning industry. I'm a land use planner in and around the city of Chico. We've already had several people get laid off, and they're still looking for a job, and it's been close to 6 months. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that then leads me really toward with that information, and now you have some real experience of colleagues in a similar situation. This leans me toward let's really protect yourself on the debt side.
Right.
Good luck, Chris.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. You know, Chris, as people are losing their jobs, it does seem prudent to do as much saving as possible because the recovery of this job market is going to take a really long time, isn't it?
It is, and it's in the numbers. I mean, recessions are always brutal because people do lose their jobs, but what is particularly disturbing about this one, it's taking a long time for people to get another job. So it just reinforces this notion of pay down your debts and save in the environment that we're in, and hopefully you come out of it with a job as opposed to losing your job.
Okay. Well, next, let's take an email from Sam in Spotswood, New Jersey. He's got a friend who is buying a house with cash, and he's wondering if this friend would be able to open up a line of equity based on, you know, the new appraised value because he's bought the house on cash. I would assume yes. I mean, if you've got all that equity, you can probably get a line of credit, right? As long as you got a good credit score and all that.
Exactly. The bank's going to look at you and say, okay, you got a lot of equity in this home, whatever it is. And, you know, here's a line of credit. Typically, that's probably the better move. Here's a line of credit. But obviously, you don't want to take out a very large line of credit. You know, one of the things, Tess, that comes out of all this experience, I'm just sort of thinking back in this type of a question, because being conservative, paying cash, you know, he wants to be able to tap into the value of that equity in order to make a loan. You know, stay really conservative. Just be conservative. And I'm going to give my own little preaching here. Why do you open up a line of credit off your home? To improve the home's value. Not for a lot of the purposes from paying from college education to going to Disney World. That's not why you take out a line of credit. It's to improve the value of the home.
All right. Well, if you've got a personal finance question, do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can go to our website. It's marketplace.org and look for the Getting Personal link there. We'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. Coming up, is sticking to a budget impossible? Well, maybe you're asking yourself, what budget?
I have gotten his expenses well under hand in the past 3 years that we've been married, but I have not been quite so enthusiastic about doing my own.
Our 30-day financial makeover begins on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We'll be right back. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. A couple of weeks ago, we invited you, dear listener, to volunteer to track your spending in full public view for 30 days. Well, Gail George, a teacher from Jacksonville, Florida, sent an email with the subject line, "Yes, I'm willing!" Exclamation point. And she joins us now to explain why she's so eager to be our financial guinea pig. Hi, Gail! Exclamation point.
Hi.
So why so eager about this?
Well, it just seems like the time is right.
Why?
I think we should all be fiscally responsible, and even if it's just a matter of tightening our belt and playing our cards a little closer to our chest right now, the economy sort of dictates that we all should do that.
Absolutely. What are you hoping to get out of this?
Education. I think that I'm probably going to be very surprised at what I spend, especially in some of the areas that are maybe ones that I don't track as carefully, like food.
Mm. You mentioned that you actually did this before. You tracked your spending about 10 years ago. Tell us about that process. How did you go about it?
I did. It was on advice of my attorney when I was getting divorced, and he just said you need to sort of understand what you're spending and how you're spending it, and could you do this for a six-month period? And I just collected all my receipts and put together a budget.
What was the biggest lesson that you learned?
I think the biggest lesson was that I can do this, that we spend money needlessly, and we can all be more careful if we just have it down on paper. I think I'm a visual processor, and I really like the idea of having the numbers right in front of me, and it's sort of like a game making them line up.
All right, well then let's talk about how you're going to track everything this time. Are you going to use a computer program, Quicken, Microsoft Money, or are you just going to do it all on paper?
Well, I thought I'd do it on paper. I did check online, and there are myriad free help create a budget programs out there that I can use. But I think initially, if it's okay with you all, I'm just going to track it on paper.
You bet. Now, will this be something that you do alone, or do you have family members who will participate?
Well, I have a husband, and he's quite willing to participate with me. I have gotten his expenses well under hand in the past 3 years that we've been married, but I have not been quite so enthusiastic about doing my own.
What do you mean you got his expenses in hand?
When we got married, he had some debt and things like that, and he no longer, as of, I think in less than 2 weeks, he'll have paid off credit cards and a car and all those things. So he's sort of well on his way to being fiscally responsible.
And how about you? Are you working to whittle down any debt?
Yes, I have one line of credit that's maxed out that I, unfortunately, a few years ago, I was living in South Florida and was waiting to move up here, and I put my house on the market right when the market fell apart in South Florida. And it took me a year to sell my house, and I had told the school that I was working at that I would not be back for the following year, so I sat in the house for a year with it unsold and no income. So I definitely used my line of credit for that, and I have one credit card, so... Well, I'm not so far gone that I don't have high hopes that I can manage my money.
Okay, so maybe this will help you get that fresh start.
I hope so.
Well, I guess we'll find out in 30 days. Thanks for opening up your finances to us, and we're looking forward to this experiment.
Wonderful, and thank you so much, Tess, for considering.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
We're back with more of your questions for Getting Personal, and our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here once again. And Chris, let's go right to Katie. She's on the phone with us from San Francisco, California. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
What's your question today?
So up until now, I have been contributing into a 401k, a pre-tax 401k, and I met with a financial advisor for the first time last week, and upon learning that all of my investments are going into pre-tax accounts, he had suggestions that would be more post-tax, and I was familiar with Roth IRAs, but he instead suggested variable annuities and cash values for whole life insurance, and he actually said if I did my own research on this, I would find information that was not favorable. So given the conflicting information, I would really like to hear Marketplace Money's opinions on this option.
All right, Chris. Variable annuities. Go.
I don't like them. Okay. I don't like variable annuities for most people. A variable annuity, just to give a quick definition, so you put after-tax money into a variable annuity, and then typically you have these mutual fund-like choices. You can put into stocks or bonds, money market mutual funds, some sort of mix. And then when you retire, as you said, you can pull the money out a variety of different ways. Typically, I don't like variable annuities. It's a high-cost product, and it's really designed for the wealthy. And I think one financial advisor put it, if you're going through your list of retirement options, you should come around fifth. For most young people, the variable annuity is not a good product.
Okay.
So there you go. You think you'll go ahead and open that Roth?
Oh, yes.
And the Roth, by the way, does have, and there is one way, I just want to add this because it is a wonderful aspect of the Roth, which is that you can tap the money that you contribute to a Roth. And you can withdraw that if you need to in an emergency without taxes or penalty. You can't tap into the gain, but the contribution, yes, because you put in after-tax dollars. So it's a nice little addition to your safety net.
Okay.
So thank you.
You bet. Thanks for calling in. And let's go to an email from Tim in Derby, Kansas. He says, with mutual funds and 529 plans so low these days, he's wondering if it's better to use these funds as planned to fund college or to go ahead and take out some student loans and leave the mutual funds and the savings alone so that over time they can perhaps get back up to where they were before this whole economic crisis started. We hope.
Okay, so this gets down to a couple of things. I have for years advocated, and I still do advocate, the age-based savings in the 529 college savings plan. So when you have a baby, you're 70% equities, and when it's time to go to college, you know, 10% equities. And that was used to be the old standard. Well, what has happened over the years is that the states and their broker-dealers have said, let's not be conservative. What's wrong with 35% equities when they're going to college 18 years old? And then you have a bear market like we have. And that's what's happening right now, is that at 35% equities, the senior year, it's vaporized.
Ugh.
So it's terrible what's happened. People do need to be more conservative. I still do like the age-based option, but you really have to check out these plans to make sure that they're offering you a conservative option so that when your 18-year-old is going to go off to college, it's mostly bonds and money market account. In fact, mostly money market account. All right, that said, if you got the money in the account, why did you save? You saved so your student, your child, wouldn't have to borrow. So if you got the money, I would take the money out of the 529 plan. I would pay for the college costs, and I think that's a wonderful world.
Even if you are what we call locking in your losses by taking that money out right now?
If you're locking in your losses and you're still having to borrow, then I'm going to change my answer a little bit. So I'm going to say you lock in some of your losses, you reduce the amount that you're borrowing. Okay, you take out that PLUS loan over the next 3-4 years. Hopefully the market will rebound, and then you'll pay off the debts. But you know what, Tess? If you can graduate your youngster from college without debt, that is a great legacy.
Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take for this week's show, but do feel free to write or call with a question of your own. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org, along with Chris's blog, where he's also taking questions from you every weekday. And Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And now we turn to questions of money and relationships. What if you were like Brad, who lives in L.A. and splits everything with his slightly in-debt boyfriend, a boyfriend who wants to spend $3,000 on a hairline-related procedure?
Dear Brad, is your boyfriend an actor, a hair transplant salesman, or a recently impeached Illinois governor? If so, the $3,000 might not be the craziest thing in the world. Without a full head of hair, how will he land roles on soap operas, sell transplant surgery, or rally support from the masses and thus ink a book deal?
That was Alana Samuels, better known to readers of the Los Angeles Times as Ask Alana. She regularly answers questions about proper money etiquette. And Alana, you must see, or I guess read it all. Give us a taste of your inbox.
One of my favorite questions was from a girl who said, you know, if you go out with a guy on 3 dates, the traditional presumption is that the guy will pay for the first date, second date, maybe even the third date.
I didn't know that.
I know. That's what a lot of people wrote in angrily. And her question was, if you feel that sparks aren't flying and you don't want to go out with him again, is it your obligation to pay for the third date? And I interviewed this very reliable online dating expert, mm-hmm. you know, and you can always trust the online experts.
Of course.
Yes, for sure. And she said that you shouldn't pay, women should not pay for the first or even the second date because men might feel emasculated. So I put that in the column and said to the girl, you don't have to pay. And I referenced, you know, in the Middle Ages, you would have to marry the guy and cook him mutton for the rest of your life. And now this is a way to get back. And I got so many angry emails from people saying, what about women's equality? Why should, what have men ever done to you? Why do you hate men so much? And I just wanted to point them to this online dating expert and say, hey, she's the expert. This is what she told me.
So it sounds like a lot of the questions you get are from people who are still in the dating mode. Do you ever hear from, you know, long-term couples, married couples who are wondering about certain financial issues that have to do with their relationship?
I had got one this time that I didn't end up answering from a woman who said she was 70 years old. She had been married for 4 years and she just found her husband's will. And he had made out his will to his children and didn't leave her with a penny. And she wasn't quite sure what to do. And I let that one go because I really didn't know the answer to that one. I think I'm more capable of giving advice for people that don't have their whole Social Security and lives riding on the answers. I also got one from a couple that had been living together for about 4 years. And the woman bought a condo and her boyfriend moved in. And he didn't want to pay because he said she was getting a tax write-off. And she said, should he have to pay? And I said, yes, he should have to pay. And I got a lot of letters from readers saying, why should he have to pay? This is going to create problems down the road. If she invited him in, it's her own problem.
Wow, people really have very strong feelings about this issue.
And I don't know if it's because I'm a woman writing or just because it's in the paper and it's kind of a little bit more of a snarky tone. But people really don't like, you know, being told that men should pay for things, it seems like.
Why do you think we all have so many issues around money in our relationships? I mean, for some people, it's something that they never even talk about. For others, it's the source of tension in their relationship. Why money?
I mean, I think there's just no answer to all these questions. You know, there's no book about, or there probably are about 100 books, actually, but there's no Bible about how to govern finances in your relationship. And there just seems to be no end of questions around love and money and no end to how people think they should be answered.
Alana Semuels writes the column Ask Alana for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I don't know if Alana's ever had to answer questions from a wife who wants to hold a yard sale and a husband who doesn't want anyone near his Bermuda grass, but those yard and garage sales are a good way to make a quick buck in a recession. We sent Cash Peters to find out what's selling on those rickety plastic tables.
Okay, so we know these are tough times, and in tough times, you have to do anything you can to make money, right?
People are learning how to save things and reuse things and recycling.
That's Susie Rosito. I met her at a yard sale in Burbank. Daniel Soap's driveway was jammed with a whole bunch of stuff she couldn't wait to get rid of.
We're having a big party for my son coming up, and I'm not working right now, so I'm thinking, well, how am I going to pay for this? So I'm having a garage sale. Last year I had one, I made $500.
Well, is there any chance I'll find something extremely valuable here that you've overlooked?
So I have some Beanie Babies. I don't know if you know what those are. I think they have those.
I was thinking more
too.
Of a Renoir, really.
Oh, no.
It's true, though. A lot of the time, the value items at garage sales are, you know, low-end. Broken espresso machines, Scrabble sets with all the H's missing, an American flag that flashes. But people love it.
Why are you here?
It's fun.
But it's rummaging through other people's old stuff.
What's your point?
Ever since I was a little girl, my father would take me to garage sales, estate sales, and I never purchased anything new. It's always used.
Some might call you cheap.
No, not really.
No, I think they might. Occasionally, of course, you find a true bargain.
You can buy furniture that they've bought at, like, Pier 1 Imports, paid $100, and they'll sell it to you for $5. The garage sales is the new thing. I think it's going to become a way of life now, just like thrift stores, because people are trying to really save money.
That's right, they are. Of course, what you're really looking for are priceless family heirlooms, preferably being sold by a dopey owner who doesn't realize he's sitting on a fortune. Stanford Cohen of Estate Sales LA is a high-end estate sale expert, but he's found many overlooked gems at garage sales.
I
often see Barbie dolls from the 1960s. I see Matchbox cars from when I was a little boy. And I see that they have them priced for 50 cents. Yes, I will buy that.
You do?
Yes, I do.
Then what do you do with them?
I put them on eBay.
Oh, of course you do, smart man. Anyway, first rule when you go to garage or estate sales, if you want the good stuff, be an early bird. Danielle.
As soon as 6 a.m. rolls around, you just pull the garage up and put everything out, and everybody's all into it. Everybody goes through your stuff like piranhas. There was a guy out here 6 a.m. waiting for us to open and wanted to buy all of our CDs.
People are crazy. Second rule of garage sales, know your stuff. Because it's not just ordinary guys like us you're competing with here. Sherry Barnett is Pasadena's garage sale queen, and she often finds art experts in her yard operating undercover. They're called pickers, and if there's a Renoir in among your Indiana Jones posters, trust me, they'll spot it.
There are people who come with scanners. They scan barcodes. And, you know, they're carrying their personal computers, they're carrying their iPhones, they're carrying...
That's a lot of professional scavengers.
There are definitely professional scavengers.
Pickers are individuals that are very, very knowledgeable. Pickers go to thrift stores, they go to garage sales, they go to estate sales. A lot of people are out there look for that vintage Gucci purse or the Louis Vuitton suitcase.
Are they hoping you didn't spot it?
Absolutely.
Mm. Something I spotted at Sherry's garage sale was a baseball cap with Turner Classic Movies on the front. Ooh, a real Hollywood artifact, I thought. Actually, the logo wasn't the only thing on it. It was covered in cat hair. Rule three, spot a bargain, be prepared to haggle.
How much for the Turner Classic Movies hat?
With or without the cat hair.
Well, are you prepared to spend half an hour stripping the cat hair off it?
All right, we will make you a special deal for that hat, with or without the cat hair.
A special meaning free?
I could do that.
Well, come on, who else is going to buy it? Lastly, though, you'd think, given that all these people are scavenging week after week for hidden gems, that there'd be no hidden gems left. Wrong. There's always something, though usually you'll find them in the bigger estate sales. Stanford.
We recently had Elizabeth Taylor's wig from Cleopatra. There were 14 wigs, and we did a fabulous house up in the Hollywood Hills, and when I saw that wig, I almost lost it.
And strangely, so did I at Danielle Sos' yard sale, where I turned up a real rarity, I thought. A collectible Beanie Baby with an American flag on it. Worth a fortune.
Some of these were sold with the American flag upside down, believe it or not, and manufactured only a few of them. I don't know how many on the first run, but I read on the internet that these are worth something like $3,000.
And how much is that really worth?
I don't know. I'm selling them for $2.50.
What a bummer. I wish I bought the baseball cap covered in cat hair now. In Los Angeles, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace Money.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, nervous about your investments? Well, that is no reason to take advice from sympathetic ads on TV.
It's not as though switching from one to another will give you better performance, which is clearly what they're promising in these ads.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Help this week from Jolie Myers. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.